realize that with one of his master's voice, all-wave or dual-wave receivers, you can go around the world without leaving your most comfortable armchair.
The ABC Social History Unit presents Making Radio Pay, the fifth program in the series Bright Sparks, Australian Radio Stories, compiled by Stephen Rapley.
By just turning the knob of your his master's voice instrument, you can listen to fascinating programs from all over the world. You might hear a film star from Hollywood, Maurice Chevalier.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to sing a song from my last picture, The Beloved Vagabond.
Each pretty little peach growing out of reach in the nursery.
Before radio could be used to sell products, it had to sell itself. It had to create its audience and its market. People were drawn to radio retailing from trades as diverse as piano tuners and pastry cooks. The boom in broadcast receiver sales during the 1930s was a long time coming, especially for the more optimistic investors. After the First World War, AWA's director and general manager Ernest Fisk focused his company's efforts on maritime wireless and international communications. According to the late Philip Jeeves, former company archivist at AWA, the demand for a broadcasting service from the growing army of experimenters and enthusiasts didn't really fit into their corporate plan.
Fisk didn't really believe in broadcasting. He used to refer to it as publicity wireless, and that was damning it out of hand, really, with faint praise. The other curious thing was that this corporate feeling about broadcasting spread throughout the company rather like a contagion. And AWA had a reputation not for establishing broadcasting stations, but acquiring what finally turned out to be a radio network rather by default, because they built stations for prospective licensees who suddenly discovered that the world was not waiting for the arrival of a new station at Moss Vale or Goulburn or Albury, and that they had expended a lot of their money, sunk a lot of capital into setting up a facility that the public really couldn't care less about. And the principal deterrent to this, of course, was the cost of radio receivers. And here AWA was again making the money because it was building receivers and was selling them at the optimum price to suit themselves. And the payment of the patent rights on receivers in those days was a very high figure indeed, and consequently it couldn't be said that the cost of a radio set was negligible to the average Australian household. And so, as I say, by default, AWA began collecting commercial stations, principally because they built them for other people who had grandiose ideas of providing entertainment to country communities, and then suddenly found that they couldn't pay for the station, so AWA had to take them over, and since the license was operative, they had to operate the station.
AWA tended to appoint its former ship's wireless operators as managers of its radio stations. The company's different vision of what radio might be is best illustrated by the short-lived sealed set scheme. Subscribers paid for a receiver which could be tuned to only one station. W.J. McClarty was the publisher of Wireless Weekly and the managing director of station 2SB, later 2BL, the first of the official broadcasters to go on the air.
In 1923, the famous Seal Set conference was held. I represented Wireless Weekly at that conference, and the conference of about 60 or 80 people in all states that were interested in wireless were addressed by Mr. Ernest Fisk, who really hypnotized his audience and persuaded them all, as he had just returned from overseas, that the best method was by sealed sets. And the conference, therefore, recommended to the government that the first broadcasting should be done with sealed sets. To obtain a license, one had to pay a fee of 12 and 6 to the government. That is for one service only. So if you want our service at 2SB was free, but farmer service you had to pay an extra 4 guineas for. As at that time it was practically impossible to make a set that would only receive one service, things became chaotic, and later on this was altered.
The government introduced a sealed set system whereby you paid a license for your 10 shillings, but your set was tuned to either one station or the other, either 3AR or 3LR. But that didn't last very long because the school kids gradually began to learn a little bit about radio, and they still had their sets converted that they could listen to either station. So the government canned that idea, and they brought in a system of 10 and 6 for an ordinary radio license to listen to either station.
Rupert Fitz, one of the founders of 3AR. The sealed sets episode was really only a marketing hiccup for radio. 1,400 licences had been taken out under the scheme, but hundreds more listened in surreptitiously. Radio was still at the stage where it had to create and maintain a high level of excitement amongst its potential listeners. Stunts became the order of the day, with each station vying to outdo its rivals and take the microphone to more bizarre and unpredictable places.
Some of the things that we were first in at 2BL was talking back, which is considered something new today, but in those days, J.M. Prentice used to answer questions, and the whole conversation of a person ringing up and J.M. Prentice's answer was broadcast. We were the first station to ever broadcast a three-act play. We were the first station to broadcast from Jenolan Caves, the first station to broadcast from the Snowy, the first station to broadcast from an aeroplane, the first to give time signals, which was the GPO clock every 15 minutes. We also broadcasted from a mine at Katoomba, with Welsh miners singing choruses in the mine. The first theatre play was broadcast by 2BL, that was the Student Prince. And also St. Mary's Cathedral Carillion.
I want you to imagine a man has just bought a new radio, and he's one of these typical dial twisters who is never satisfied with one program. You hear the news, a dramatic play, the market prices, and London, England. But really, he doesn't care what program he gets. He just loves to turn on the radio, and this is what happens when he turns it on. It was officially reported this evening that Mr. Neville Chamberlain stated in the House of Commons,
"Oh, Dora, my darling Dora, you know how much I love you."
"Oh, but Francis, it cannot be so."
"Oh, but don't you hear the sound of sweet music? Dora, if you would only come with me, the sights that we could see.
5,000 hogs and 3,000 sheep. Some hogs active, others slow. How is your stomach? If you have an acid stomach, why don't you enjoy Teddy White and his Hawaiian singers and players?"
It was about that time that someone, I think it was the local storekeeper, who probably had more money than most, he was the person, I think, who bought and installed the first radio in the town. And it was a wondrous experience. He used to leave the doors open and let this thing play, and he'd go for a walk at night and be able to hear it and so on, in the silence, of course.
What silence?
The silence of the town, because there were no motor cars going through. All the motor cars had been put away, both of them. And just the occasional train through, but just total silence, apart from wind noise or anything like that.
a radio, you could hear it streets away, even though they weren't very loud in those days, but nevertheless, you could hear it. My grandfather also bought a radio in the early days. At first, he had a pair of headphones, and the way you listened to it was that you'd take the headphones apart, and one person would have one phone held up to their ear, and the other person would hold the other one up to their ear, and you'd pass it round if there were more than two people present. Then he brought a loudspeaker, which is then known as a Brown's Table Talker. It was rather like an overgrown loudspeaker sitting flat on its back on the table with a long, elongated horn coming up and standing vertically above it and coming to a wide mouth, of course. And it allowed people in the room to hear what was going on from this overgrown headphone, really, Brown's Table Talker. Those are the first two radios that I remember.
Radio had the greatest impact on people living in the country. Neville Williams remembers the time before radio was common in the town where he grew up, Bargo, in New South Wales.
It was isolated. Our papers had to come by train. They only arrived sometime much later in the day. And therefore there was no immediacy about news. There was no radio. There was no immediacy about news at all. Things happened in the big city that incredibly weren't often reported locally until much, much later. I remember on one occasion, I think this was about 1926 odd, when the working hours were changed from 48 to 44 hours, and that meant working days were dropped from 6 to 5.5. Now, you'd have thought that everybody would have known about that pending change, but I remember very vividly on the Saturday when this came about, and I was in the garden of our little farmlet with my mother around lunchtime on Saturday when chut-chut-chut-chut, my father arrived back home on his motorbike, and my mother went quite grey because she thought he's lost his job. But he didn't look as if he's lost his job. And when he finally pulled up, he explained that he was home early because they'd cut the working hours and in future he would only have to work 5.5 days. And the first time he'd heard about it was when he got to work that day. That's the sort of isolation I'm talking about.
The first station in Western Australia was 6WF, owned by a farmers cooperative, Westralian Farmers. George Moss.
Westralian Farmers was originally set up as a cooperative for country farmers, and they made their purchases mainly through Westralian Farmers and, of course, got a dividend from the profits which the cooperative made every year. And so when Westralian Farmers set up they obtained the radio wireless license in those days for the broadcast transmitter. They had a ready-made market of customers in the country to whom they could market their sets, and it worked out very well.
The sets sold to farmers to receive 6WF were known as Mulga phones. Another well-known brand from the West was the Beatty phone.
Stan Beatty, an old mate of mine, Stan was the initiator of the package deal. He would sell you the complete set, which he made on his own premises, two lengths of 3x2-inch timber for the masts, the copper wire to go between to make the aerial, the insulators to insulate the aerial from the masts, and the whole thing was there packaged for you. The batteries to go, of course, the battery operation in those days, no power sets. And he sold a lot of sets, and he used to go around the country himself, installing and erecting them, go from farm to farm, putting them up, and he was a pretty busy man for a while.
I should tell you that one of the many advantages of his master's voice radio is that it is very simple to operate. A large, edge-lit dial makes tuning in a real pleasure. It's easy to read, easy to follow. Let us now pick up the transmissions which cross the Pacific. From South America, you might hear the exotic rumbo from Rio de Janeiro in Brazil.
Broadcasting stations boosted radio as an exciting new technology able to conquer distance. The press joined the campaign, reporting each new achievement, such as the first shortwave reception of overseas stations in 1925.
Frank Goldsmith, who was then a reporter on the Daily News, had the job of going round daily to the workplaces of the various amateurs and getting reports from them what they heard the night before and writing it up in his daily column. And I still have some of the column cuttings. Column inches must have been very cheap in those days, because on several days he'd have a whole column in the paper giving the listing the results the various amateurs received. I feature in some of them. He used to come and get my report too. And I still see him rushing up the stairs to the workshop where I was working and getting my story, and then rushing down again off to the next one. Frank got so engrossed in amateur radio by his contact in this that he eventually became an amateur himself and became VK6FG, FG for Frank Goldsmith.
Ted Huckle was a pioneer radio retailer in Sydney. He started out building and selling small shortwave receivers in the late 1920s.
I used to put the set in the car. It was a battery-operated set. And knock on the door of the house at about 10 o'clock. And so I brought the set. They'd already paid the £10. I'd go into, say, the living room or the breakfast room or wherever they were, if there was a table, put it on the table and pull out a length of wire about 100 feet and go to the closest window and drop it out the window and then go around the back garden and pick up the coil of wire and usually put it right along the top of the adjoining fence next door. It's easy to do. You hang it up anywhere. It doesn't matter. And go back inside, switch the set on, hear the noise on the headphones, and very close up to coming to 10:30. You hear the noise of the clock, and just as you know it was going to strike, you pull the headphones out of the plug, and it comes on the loudspeaker. Enough to fill the room, enough to fill the house. Big Ben, bang. It's a sensation. It's a marvellous sensation. The people there, they're English people, always, nearly always English people. And they're thrilled to pieces. Big Ben. You can recognise it again. You go through the news, you've sold the set, there it is. You show them how to change it over to the local stations.
So were they easy to sell then, at 10:30 at night?
Oh, they were easy to sell, but you didn't have very many people with £10 to spend on short waves, that's all. No, it wasn't a good business.
Hello, Melbourne. We are now going to rebroadcast an item from 5SW Chelmsford, England. Now, boys and girls, you remember I told you about the started from boys to Madam Nora Ierzoff, rebroadcast by us from 5SW Chelmsford, England.
Very clever.
Regarding demonstrations, we've found in the past that once we are allowed to demonstrate our Model 20 or any of our sets in the house, we take it there and leave it there for a night or two and then come back and say, "Mr. Jones, how's the machine?" And he says, "Not too bad. Here's your check. The sale is made." Once we are able to show our machine and let the people hear the wonderful tone and results and the ease of control, we, in every case, make a sale. I very often find it advisable to leave the machine in the home and then say, "We will call back for it tomorrow or in 2 or 3 days' time." When we go, they have a little experiment themselves and they find they can bring in Adelaide and they say, "This is a wonderful machine." If we let it go over a week, we find the novelty is gone. And they say, £50 is a lot of money, we'll stick to the money. And we lose the sale.
I got my sign writer to put up a sign. It was 100 square feet. It was on an angle that you could read it easily for a quarter of a mile away, because it only had one word on it. R-A-D-I-O. And it was 3 feet high and 15 feet long each way. So you couldn't miss it. It was a radio shop. And I put a clock there. It was the only clock between Manly and Rawson. It had radio on it.
Ted Huckle's radio shop in Cremorne became famous locally for its elaborate window displays.
Now, my main conception was publicity. I was a corner shop, and you could see it for 100 feet away. And it had to be well lit. I used 100-watt spotlights with plenty of reflecting direction right down onto the floor. I used to do a lot of window displays. When anything was going in town, like Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs or anything like that, I'd follow the general direction of what was popular. For instance, when Smithy got lost, I had a big map of Australia, and I spotted it up with bright lights. And I put a bulletin board on the side of the window to write bulletins on what I received from the news. And anything I received over radio, because very few people had radio. I don't know, they might have a crystal set or something like that, but there wasn't a radio in every home by any means. And they used to come to the shop for news.
I don't know how most people listened, but certainly the way that we did in 1932-33 was on a crystal set that my father had made years before, which was made in a cigar box. I still associate early days of radio with the smell of Cuban cigar boxes. The problem, of course, that you've probably heard of, is that you had a crystal which was a lump of galena, a piece of a blue-sheened lead sulfide, and there was a brass wire that you had to find a sensitive spot on the galena, and that you adjusted. Adjusted is the wrong word. You had to pick a bit here, pick a bit there, until you got the best spot. And then you would hope that nobody would walk through the room, slam the door. It caused dreadful family ructions if somebody walked through the room while you were listening to the radio. And they were the conditions that we listened to radio in those days. 1935, when we were starting to come out of the Depression, we actually bought ourselves a Mantle radio, and that was a great day when you could get volume out of the thing.
Well, you've got to attract people, and you put one near the door that looks all right, and you put 14 guineas on it, see? And it costs 10, you're only making 4 quid. That's to get the person to come into the shop. And he comes into the shop to buy the 14 guinea set, and to make the set not such a good tone, we used to put a 0.5 condenser in the bypass of the second detector to spoil the sound. So the sound wasn't full and round and everything that you'd like. He'd come into the shop and he'd look at the set and he'd want to buy that set because it was 14 guineas. And you turn it on and you'd listen to it. And he'd be quite satisfied himself, not knowing anything. And then you take him round and show them the better-looking cabinets in the shop. And you tell him, you're not buying the set for the cabinet. You can put it in a soapbox and get a good set. But if you've got a better set, you'll give it a better cabinet. In consequence, the sets on the stands in the shop were better sets than the one at the door. That's why they were higher in price. They're 18 guineas, not 14. And they're more expensive to build, and they're a better cabinet, and all that sort of thing, and it all goes with and makes your home look better because it's a better-looking set, and it makes your home sound better because it's a better-sounding set. So you put a 0.5 condenser in a second detector. But in the boot sets, the only difference is that it's a 25 microfarad. Instead of a 0.5 microfarad, it goes into the detector and it gives you the full flavour of the sound.
You told me someone bought the
receiver set. Yes, the bloke bought it. He went out and he stole it. He wanted a 14-guinea set. He got a 14-guinea set. And about 18 months afterwards, Jack said he came in for some defect they wanted. And he said, this is the bloke who's bought the 14-guinea set. About the only one. And, I said, don't be bloody lousy. He can put a 25 mic in it at the stage. So he got the real sound. That's only a trick.
Ted Huckle and Neville Teal. When Walter Exton worked at his father's commercial station 2XN in Lismore, New South Wales, he had to teach himself new skills, from looking after the members of the Kookaburra Club to writing advertising copy.
I think we must have had about 100 or more children in this session, and we would take them out on Saturday afternoons for picnics, a run out into the country, in buses, incidentally. And the buses, we acquired the use of the buses by giving advertising to the bus management in each case, which didn't cost us anything, because we didn't have anything. Anyhow, the point is that we would take them out to the country, out to, say, a farm this Saturday, or we'd take them for a picnic in the park. I don't remember who supplied the sandwiches, but we always had them. But it was the same thing over and over again. We would go to the pictures sometimes. And there again, the pictures were always free to us because they used to take it out in advertising. And this was a great thing. We spent we got a lot of money in, and that. But it was only, we didn't actually get the money, we got the goodwill. But I can remember one year my father, I think, told me he made 10 shillings a week out of the station. You know, I mean, it cost him £1,700 to put in to make 10 shillings a week. Well, it wasn't much. But we had a lot of fun anyhow, in one way or another.
The time is 9:17, and there was a young lady named May who went to the beach for the day. But she went down on Sunday and came back on Monday, said, blow the old washing, I'll stay. She knew that by using So-Slick washing compound, she didn't have to hurry back. Just a little So-Slick in the copper, and the washing's done. You don't need extra soap with So-Slick. It's a soap powder extract. This half holiday wrapped in cellophane is priced at 4d/halfpenny at your store. Ask for So-Slick washing compound.
It was a period of trial and error, experimentation, because we didn't know. We didn't know anything about radio. We had to make it up as we went along. And now, for instance, the writing of ads was one thing I can remember quite well. People who were advertising with us used to write their own copy and send it down. And it amounted to such things as, buy your sweater from Joe Blow, it's 19 and 11 pence or whatever it was, you see. Well, I mean, there was nothing imaginative about this. It was just simply a matter of stating the facts. Well, now, we had to try and think of something else. So I sat down on odd occasions, and I tried to think out, and I thought, well, I'll do a dialogue, see how that works out. Well, that was a bit different. It was something we'd discovered, and it was a period of experimenting as we went along.
In Making Radio Pay, you heard Ted Huckle, Neville Williams, George Moss, and Walter Exton. Interviews with Neville Teal, Rupert Fitz, W.J. McLardy, and Philip Jeeves are from the ABC Radio Archives. In the next program in the series, Soldering On, we'll hear about making radios. Thanks to Tony Baldwin for the vintage radiogram advertisements and Alec Templeton's Man with a New Radio. Readings, Scott McGregor. Theme music for the series was composed and performed by Kathy Peters. Production of Bright Sparks, Sharon Davis, Peter McLeod and Stephen Rapley for the ABC's Social History Unit.